Good to see you, said Austin, appraising Peter's conventional attire with obvious approval. You're looking much better.
I'm sure I smell better, said Peter. I'm sorry I stank up your surgery.
Couldn't be helped, breezed the doctor.
Alcohol is evil stuff.
That was as close as he was going to come to mentioning Granger's unprofessional insobriety. You're walking a bit stiffly, he observed, as the two of them moved from the doorway into the consulting room. How are your injuries?
They're fine. I'm just not used to wearing clothes, these sorts of clothes, anymore.
Austin smiled insincerely, no doubt adjusting his professional assessment of how well Peter was doing.
Yes, there are days I quite fancy coming to work naked, he joked. But the feeling passes.
Peter smiled in return. One of his flashes of pastoral instinct, like the one he'd had about Lover One's inconsolable sadness, came to him now. This doctor, this ruggedly good-looking New Zealand male, this man called Austin, had never had a sexual relationship with anyone.
I want to thank you, said Austin, for taking our conversation seriously.
Conversation?
About the natives' health. About getting them to come to us so we can check them out, diagnose what they're dying of. Obviously, you've been spreading the word.
And he smiled again, to acknowledge the unintended evangelical meaning of the phrase.
At long last, one of them has.
Long last.
Peter thought of the distance between the Yusik base and the Shishkoda settlement, the time it took to drive there, the time it would take to walk.
Oh my gosh, he said. It's so far.
No, no, Austin reassured him. Remember Conway, your good Samaritan? Apparently he wasn't satisfied with the signal strength of some doodad he'd installed at your church. So he went there again, and lo and behold, he came back with a passenger. A friend of yours, I gather.
Friend?
Austin extended his hand, motioned toward the corridor.
Come with me. He's in intensive care.
The term stuck a cold spike into Peter's guts. He followed Austin out of the room, down the hallway a few steps, and into another room marked ICU. Only one patient lay in the spotless 12-bed facility. Tall IV drip stands, gleaming new and with transparent plastic sheaths still hugging their aluminium stems, stood sentinel by each empty bed. The lone patient wasn't hooked to a drip, nor was he attached to any other tentacles of medical technology. He sat erect against pillows, tucked up to the waist in pure white linen, his faceless, hairless kernel of head flesh unhooded. In the great rectangle of mattress designed to accommodate American bodies the size of BGs, he looked pathetically small. His robe and gloves had been replaced with a thin cotton hospital gown, pale grey-green like stale broccoli, the colour Peter associated with Jesus Lover 23, but that didn't mean he was Jesus Lover 23, of course. With a shame so intense it was close to panic, Peter realised he had no way of knowing who this was. All he knew was that the Shishkoda's right hand was wrapped in a bulbous mitten of white gauze. In the left hand, he clutched a shabby toiletries bag. No, it wasn't a bag. It was a Bible pamphlet. One of Peter's hand-sewn assemblages. The paper had been dampened and dried so many times it had the texture of leather. The loose strands of wool were yellow and pink. Seeing Peter enter, the Shishkoda cocked his head to one side, as if puzzled by the minister's bizarrely unfamiliar raiment.
God bless our reunion, Father Peter.
Lover Five?
Yes.
Peter turned to Austin. What's wrong with her? Why is she here?
She?
The doctor blinked. Pardon me. He reached for a clipboard on which a single sheet was clamped, and, with a scrawl of a pen, he amended the patient's gender.
Well, as you can see from the bandage, he continued, escorting Peter to Lover Five's bedside,
she sustained a hand injury. A very serious hand injury, I must say. He motioned to the gauze mitten,
May I?
This last question was directed at the patient.
Yes,
she said.
So.
While the bandages were being unwrapped, Peter recalled the day of Lover Five's injury, the painting falling from the ceiling, the bruise on her hand, the fervid sympathy offered by her fellow Shishchuda, and how, ever since then, she'd been protective of that hand, as if the memory of that injury refused to fade. The white mitten dwindled in size until Austin removed the last of the gauze. A sweet fermented smell was released into the room. Lover Five's hand was no longer a hand. The fingers had fused into a bluish-grey clump of rot. It looked like an apple that had sustained a bruise and then been left for weeks. Oh my God, Peter breathed. Do you speak her language? Said Austin. Because I'm not sure how to get proper consent here. I mean, not that there's any alternative to amputation, but even explaining what a general anesthetic is. Oh. My. God. Lover Five ignored the men's conversation, ignored the putrid mess on the end of her wrist. With her uninjured hand, she opened her Bible pamphlet, deftly using three fingers to flip to a particular page. In a clear voice, unhampered, thanks to her pastor, by impossible consonants, she recited,
"The Lord give them power in their bed of pain and make them whole again."
And, from the same page of inspirational selections from Psalms and Luke,
"The people learned the good new way and followed him. He welcomed them and helped them know God and healed all them who needed healing."
She raised her head to fix her attention on Peter. The bulges on her face that resembled the knees of fetuses seemed to glow.
"I need healing," she said. "Or I die."
Then, after a brief silence, in case there was any ambiguity that should be clarified,
"I wish, please, to live."
My God. My God. Peter kept saying 10 meters down the hall as Austin leaned against the edge of his consulting room desk, arms awkwardly folded. The doctor was tolerant of the pastor's emotional incontinence. He wouldn't dream of telling him that nothing was achieved by all this groaning and fist clenching and agitated face wiping. Even so, as the minutes ticked on, he became more keen to discuss the way forward. "She'll have the best of care," he reassured Peter. "We have everything here. Not to blow my own horn, but I'm a pretty good surgeon. And Dr. Adkins is even better. Remember the great job he did on you? If it sets your mind at rest, he can do her as well. In fact, yes, I'll make sure he definitely does her." "But don't you realize what this means?" cried Peter. "Don't you fucking realize what this means?" The doctor flinched at the unexpected cursing from a man who was, as far as he'd been given to understand, a bona fide Christian minister. "Well, I appreciate that you're upset," he remarked carefully. "But I don't think we should jump to any pessimistic conclusions." Peter blinked tears from his eyes, allowing him to see the doctor's face in focus. The ragged scar on Austin's jaw was as conspicuous as ever, but now, rather than wondering how Austin got it, Peter was struck by the scar's essential nature. It was not a disfigurement. It was a miracle. All the scars ever suffered by anyone in the whole of human history were not suffering, but triumph. Triumph against decay. Triumph against death. The wounds on Peter's arm and leg, healing still. The scabs on his ears, gone now. Every trifling scratch and burn and rash and bruise, thousands of injuries over the years, right back to the ankle bones he'd broken the week before he'd met B, his skinned knees when he'd fallen off his bike as a kid, the nappy rash he'd probably experienced as a baby. None of them has stopped him being here today. He and Austin were comrades in stupendous luck. The gouge in Austin's chin, which must have been a gory mess when it was first inflicted, had not reduced the entire head to a slimy lump. It magicked itself into fresh pink flesh. "Nothing shall hurt you," said Luke. "When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned," said Isaiah. "The Lord healeth all thy diseases," said Psalms. There it was. There it was. Plain as the scar on this smug doctor's face. The perpetual reprieve the Oasens called the technique of Jesus. Chapter 25. Some of us have work to do. Outside, the sky turned dark, even though it was day. Ominous cloud masses had formed, dozens of them, almost perfectly circular, like giant moons of vapor. Peter stared at them through the window of his room. Lover One had once assured him that there were no storms on Oasis. It looked like that was about to change. The giant globes of moisture as they advanced became at once more familiar and more alarming. They were swirls of rain, only rain, no different in their motion from the rain swirls he'd witnessed many times before. But their relationship with the sky around them was not as subtle and freely shifting as usual. Instead, it was as though each vast congregation of water droplets was restrained by an inner gravitational pull, held together like a planet or some gaseous heavenly body. And the spheres were so dense that they had lost some of their transparency, casting an oppressive pall over what had been a bright morning. "There are rain clouds on the way," he thought of writing to B, and was hit with a double distress. The memory of the state B was in, and deep shame at how inadequate his letters to her were, how inadequate they'd been from the beginning. If he could have described what he'd experienced better, she might not have felt so separated from him. If only the tongue that God lent him when he was called upon to speak in public to strangers could have come to his aid when writing in private to his wife. He sat at the chute and checked for a message. None. The truth was as plain as a dull blank screen where words had once glowed. She saw no point in responding to him now. Or she was unable to respond. Too busy, or too upset, or in trouble. Maybe he should write again regardless. Not wait for an answer, just keep sending messages. The way she had done for him when he'd first got here. Message after message, which he'd left unanswered. He searched his mind for words that might give her hope. Maybe something along the lines of, "Hope is one of the strongest things in the universe. Empires can fall, civilizations can vanish into dust." But no. The rhetoric of a sermon was one thing. His wife's grim reality was another. Civilizations did not vanish smoothly and easily. Empires did not set like suns. Empires collapsed in chaos and violence. Real people got pushed around, beaten up, robbed, made destitute. Real lives went down the toilet. B was scared and hurt, and she didn't need his preaching. "B, I love you," he wrote. "I'm so worried about you." Was it right to spend $5,000 of U6 money to send those 9 impotent little words through space? With barely a moment's hesitation, he pressed the transmission button. The letters trembled on the screen for 2, 3, then 4 minutes, making Peter fear that his feelings had been judged by some jaded shift worker elsewhere in the building, to have failed a test, to have sinned against the USIC ethos, attempting to undermine the great mission. Staring at the screen, sweat forming on his brow, he belatedly noticed the typo, a semicolon instead of an apostrophe. He lifted his hand to fix it, but the words evaporated. "Approved. Transmitted," the screen said in a wink. Thank God for that. Outside the compound, a rumble of thunder.
Peter prayed. In every Christian's life, there comes a time when he or she needs to know the precise circumstances under which God is willing to heal the sick. Peter had reached that pass now. Until today, he'd muddled through with the same hodgepodge of faith, medicine, and common sense that everyone else in his church back in England was likely to rely on. Drive carefully. Take the pills as stated on the package. Pour cold water on a scald. Get the cyst removed by a surgeon. Be mindful that a Christian diabetic needs insulin just as much as an atheist diabetic does. Regard a heart attack as a warning. Remember that all human beings must die, but remember too that God is merciful and may snatch your life back from the jaws of death if what? A few hundred meters from here, confined in a metal cot, lay Lover 5. So small and helpless in that big empty space labelled intensive care. Nothing that U6 doctors had to offer could fix the rot in her flesh. Amputating her hand would be like cutting the rotten part out of an apple. It was just tidying up the fruit as it died. But God could what? God could cure cancer. That had been proven many times. An inoperable tumor could, through the power of prayer, miraculously shrink. Sentences of death could be commuted for years, and although Peter disapproved of charlatan faith healers, he had seen people wake from supposedly fatal comas, had seen hopelessly premature babies survive, had even seen a blind woman regain her sight. But why did God do it for some Christians and not for others? Such a basic question, too simple-minded for theologians to bother discussing at their synods. But what was the answer? To what extent did God feel bound to respect the laws of biology, letting calcifying bones crumble, poisoned livers succumb to cirrhosis, severed arteries gush blood? And if the laws of biology on Oasis were such that the Shish Chodeh couldn't heal, that the mechanism for healing didn't even exist, was there any point in praying to God for help? Dear God, please don't let Lover 5 die. It was such an infantile prayer, the sort of prayer a 5-year-old might pray. But maybe those were the best kind. What with the thunder in the skies outside and the rumble of worry in his own head, it was difficult for him to recognize the knocking at his door for what it was. Eventually, he opened up. "How are you feeling?" said Granger, dressed for going out. "Like hell," he almost said. "I'm very upset and worried about my friend." "But physically?" "Physically? Are you up for going out with me?" Her voice was firm and dignified. She was wholly back to normal now. Her eyes were clear, no longer red-rimmed. She didn't smell of alcohol. In fact, she was beautiful. More beautiful than he'd given her credit for before. As well as her usual driving shawl, she wore a white tunic top with loose sleeves that barely reached past her elbows, exposing the network of scars on her pale forearms to public view. "Take me as I am," was the message. "We can't leave Tartaglione to rot," she said. "We've got to bring him back." "He doesn't want to come back," said Peter. "He feels utter contempt for everybody here." "He's just saying that," said Granger, bristling with impatience. "I know him. We used to talk. He's a real interesting guy, very smart and charming, and sociable. He'll go insane out there." A naked bogeyman from medieval depictions of the damned leapt around in Peter's memory. "He's insane already." Granger's eyes narrowed. "That's kind of judgmental, wouldn't you say?" Peter looked away, too burdened with care to argue. Clumsily, he pretended to be distracted by the demands of unloading the washing machine. "Anyway," said Granger, "I'll talk to him. You don't have to talk to him. Just get him to come out of hiding. Whatever you did last time, do it again." "Well," Peter recalled, "I was stumbling around in pitch darkness, delirious, convinced I was dying, loudly reciting a paraphrase of Psalm 23. If that's what it takes, I'm not sure I could,
replicate the conditions.
She put her hands on her hips provocatively. So does that mean you're not willing to give it a shot? And so they set off. Not in the delivery jeep Granger preferred for her drug and food runs, but in the hearse-like station wagon Peter had commandeered, the one with the bed in the back. Granger took a while to adjust to driving it, sniffing at its unfamiliar smells, fiddling with its unfamiliar controls, wriggling her buttocks on the unfamiliar shape of its seat. She was a creature of habit. All the U6 staff were creatures of habit, he realized now. There wasn't a reckless adventurer among them. Ella Reinemann's vetting process made sure of that. Maybe he, Peter, was the closest thing to an adventurer they'd ever allowed to come here. Or maybe Tartaglione was the closest, and that's why he'd gone insane. I figure he's more likely to show, Granger explained, if the vehicle's the same. He probably saw you coming for ages. It was night. The vehicle would have lit itself up. He could have been watching it from a mile away. Peter thought this was unlikely. He was more inclined to believe that Tartaglione had been watching the twinkles in his vat of moonshine, watching musty memories slowly decay inside his own skull. What if we don't find him?
We'll find him, said Granger, focusing her eyes on the featureless landscape.
But what if we don't?
She smiled.
You gotta have faith.
The heavens rumbled. A few minutes later, Peter said, May I check the chute? Granger fumbled on the dashboard, not sure where the chute was located in this vehicle. A drawer slid out like a tongue, offering two repulsive objects that looked like large mummified slugs, but which, at second glance, were moldy cigars. Another drawer revealed some sheets of printed paper that had turned rainbow colors and shriveled to a fragile tissue resembling autumn leaves. Evidently, the USIC personnel had made little or no use of Kurtzberg's hearse since his disappearance. Maybe they regarded it as cursed with bad luck, or maybe they'd made a conscious decision to leave it just as it was, in case the minister came back one day. Granger's fingers found the chute at last and swiveled it over Peter's lap. He switched it on. Everything looked and behaved as it should. He checked for messages from B. Nothing. Maybe this particular machine was not configured like the others. Maybe its promise of connection was an illusion. He checked again, reasoning that if B had sent a message, a few extra seconds could make all the difference between its not yet having arrived and its arrival. Nothing. The sky continued to darken as they drove further. Not exactly black as sackcloth, but certainly ominous. Thunder boomed again.
I've never seen it like this, he said.
Granger glanced cursorily out the side window.
I have, she said.
Then, sensing his skepticism, she added, I've been here longer than you. She shut her eyes and breathed deep.
Too long.
What happens?
Happens?
When it goes dark like this.
She sighed. It rains. It just rains. What do you expect? This place is one big anticlimax.
He opened his mouth to speak, to defend the awesome beauties of this planet, or else to make some comment about the USIC project. He would never know which, because as he opened his lips, a fork of lightning split the sky. The windows flared with a blinding flash, and the vehicle was struck from above as if by a colossal fist. Shuddering from the bang, the car rolled to a standstill.
Jesus!
Cried Granger. She was alive. They were both alive. And not just that. They were holding each other by the arm, squeezing tight. Animal instinct. Embarrassed, they unclasped. No harm had come to them. Not even a hair on their head was singed. The chute suspended over Peter's lap had gone blank, its screen reflecting his own bone-white face. On the dashboard in front of him, all the glowing words and symbols were gone. Granger reached forward to prompt the ignition and was exasperated to find that the engine failed to revive.
That's not supposed to happen, she said. Her eyes were a little wild.
She was possibly in shock. Everything should still be working fine. She kept turning the ignition, to no avail. Fat raindrops began to splash against the windows.
The lightning must have blown something, said Peter.
Impossible, said Granger.
No way.
Granger, it's amazing enough that we survived.
She was having none of it.
A car is the safest place to be in a thunderstorm, she insisted. The metal shell acts as a Faraday cage.
Observing the incomprehension on his face, she added,
Grade school science.
I must have been away from school that day, he said,
as she examined, prodded, and tickled controls and gauges that were clearly dead. The odor of fried circuitry began to seep into the cabin. The downpour clattered against the windows, which fogged up until Peter and Granger were confined inside an opaque casket.
I cannot believe this, said Granger. All of our vehicles are designed to take punishment. They're built like cars used to be, before people started to load them full of dumbass technology that breaks down all the damn time.
She pulled the headscarf off. Her face was flushed, her neck wet with sweat.
We need to think, said Peter gently, about what to do.
She leaned her head back against the seat, stared up at the roof. The patter of the rain beat out a military rhythm, like soldiers from a long past millennium walking into battle with their snare drums slung on their hips.
We've only been driving for a few minutes, Granger said. The base may still be in sight.
Reluctant to step outside the vehicle and get soaked, she twisted round in her seat and tried to look out the back window. There was nothing to see except fogged glass and the bed. She swung open the door, letting in a gleeful swarm of humid air, and hove herself into the rain. She stood next to the car for 20 seconds or more, her clothing trembling and flapping as it got pelted. Then she took her seat again and shut the door.
No sign, she said.
Her tunic was drenched, transparent. Peter could see the delineation of her bra, the points of her nipples.
And no sign of C1 either. We must be exactly halfway.
She stroked the steering wheel in frustration. The rain passed over. The sky brightened up, casting pearly light on their bodies. Tendrils of air nudged under Granger's sleeves, visibly lifting the sodden fabric, traveling underneath like swollen veins. They penetrated Peter's clothing, too, slipping inside his t-shirt, up his trouser cuffs, tickling the hollows of his knees. They were especially keen to get past the tight ruck of denim around his genitals.
Walking back would take us an hour, said Granger.
2 hours max.
Have the tires left tracks in the dirt?
She went out again to check.
Yes, she said on her return. Straight and clear. One last time she turned the ignition, casually and without looking at it, as if hoping to trick the engine into performing despite itself.
Looks like Tartaglione made a deal with God, she said.
They packed carefully for the journey. Granger filled a tote bag with first aid provisions. Peter found a mildewed old briefcase of Kurtzberg's, removed a New Testament which had fused into a solid block, and replaced it with a couple of plastic 2-liter bottles of water.
I wish there was a shoulder strap for this, he said, testing the briefcase in his grip.
These bottles are heavy.
They'll be lighter as we drink them, said Granger.
It'll rain again twice before we're at the base, prophesied Peter.
What good will that do us?
You just lift your head and open your mouth, he said.
That's how the Shishkoda, the natives, do it.
If you don't mind, said Granger, I'd rather not do it the way the natives do it.
The outside of the vehicle, they noted, was disfigured with scorch marks. A web of damage tattooed the hubcaps, and all four tires had deflated. The vehicle had ceased to be a vehicle and begun its metamorphosis into something else. Peter and Granger followed the tire tracks back toward the USIC compound. Granger was a good walker, shorter legged than her companion, but with a brisk enough pace for him not to need to hobble his speed. They covered a decent distance in a short time, and despite the flatness of the land, the vehicle grew rapidly smaller in retrospect and then vanished altogether. As they walked on, The tracks became more difficult to discern in the rain-smooth soil. There was ambiguity between man-made and naturally occurring patterns. The sky's ominous pall evaporated, and the sun shone bright and constant. Granger took swigs from one of the water bottles. Peter was okay to wait. He was more hungry than thirsty. In fact, the gnaw of appetite distracted him as he walked. The ground was not the best terrain for progress on foot, but they must have covered 2 miles at least in the first hour. In the second hour, perhaps the same. The Usyk base obstinately refused to manifest on the horizon. All traces of their outward journey were by now erased from the soil. They were, of course, hopelessly lost. "If we retrace our steps to the car, Usyk may send someone to check it out," suggested Peter. "Eventually." "Yeah," said Granger. "Eventually. When we're dead." They were both taken aback to hear the words spoken so prematurely. Even though the mistake they'd made hung obvious in the air, there was an etiquette of optimism to be observed. "You came to fetch me," Peter reminded her. She laughed out loud at his naivete. "That was on my own initiative. It had nothing to do with Usyk. Those guys wouldn't rescue their own mothers. I mean, literally. Why do you think they're here in the first place? They're cool. They might as well have 'shit happens' tattooed on their foreheads." "But they'll notice you're missing." "Oh, I'm sure. Somebody will come to the pharmacy for a tube of wart killer, and I won't be there, and they'll think, 'Hey, no sweat. A few warts ain't so bad.' And when I don't turn up to test tomorrow's food, 'Hey, it's just a formality. We'll eat it anyway. Maybe mention it at the next meeting.'" "I can't believe they'd be so unconcerned," said Peter. But his voice was weakened by uncertainty. "I know these guys," said Granger. "I know how they operate. They noticed Kurtzberg and Tartaglioni were missing, after God knows how long. What did they do? Did they send vehicles out in all directions, driving day and night until they covered every inch of a 50-mile radius? Forget it, baby. Chill out and read a magazine. Flex a bicep. The fucking world is falling apart, and it still doesn't rate as an emergency. Do you really think they're going to panic over us?"
"I would hope so," said Peter.
"Well, hope is a fine thing," she sighed. They walked further and began to tire.
"Maybe we should stop walking," said Peter.
"And do what instead?"
"Rest a while."
They sat on the earth and rested a while. Two cotton-wrapped pink mammals marooned on a dark ocean of soil. Here and there, a few small clumps of white flower grew, sweating in the sunshine. Peter reached out to one near his foot, plucked off a fragment, and put it in his mouth. It tasted bad. How strange that a substance which, when ingeniously processed, cooked, and seasoned, could be delicious in so many ways, should be so unpleasant in its pure form.
"Enjoying that?" said Granger.
"Not much," he said. "I'll wait till we're back at the base," she said lightly. "Good menu today. Chicken curry and ice cream." She smiled, willing him to forgive her earlier lapse of morale. Not much refreshed, they walked on. And on. Granger had drunk half a water bottle by now, and Peter drank his fill direct from the sky, when just as he'd foretold, another rain shower drenched them.
"Hey!"
called Granger as he swayed erect and awkward, his head tilted back, Adam's apple bobbing, mouth wide open to the downpour.
"You look like a turkey!"
Peter put on a grin, as Granger's comment was clearly meant in fun. But he felt his grin falter as he realized that he'd forgotten what turkeys looked like. All his life he'd known, starting from the first day his parents had shown him a picture of one in a book. Now, in his brain's storehouse, where so many Bible passages lay spotlit ready for quoting, he searched for a picture to go with turkey, and there was none to be found. Granger noticed. Noticed and was not pleased.
"You don't remember, do you?" she said, as they sat down together once more.
"You've forgotten what a turkey looks like." He confessed with a nod, caught out like a naughty child. Until now, Only B had ever been able to guess what he was thinking.
Mental blank, he said.
That's what happens, said Granger, solemn and intense. That's what this place is about. That's how it works. It's like one huge dose of propranolol, erasing everything we ever knew. You mustn't let them break you. Her sudden vehemence discomforted him.
I'm probably just absent-minded.
That's what you've got to watch, she said, hugging her knees, contemplating the empty tundra ahead of them. Absence. The slow, insidious disposal of everything. Listen, you want to know what got discussed at the last USIC personnel meeting? Besides technical stuff and the bad smell in the loading bay behind H-Wing? I'll tell you. Whether we really need all those pictures hanging in the hallways. They're just a dusting and cleaning problem, right? An old photo of a city on Earth somewhere, way back when, with a bunch of guys eating lunch on a steel girder. It's cute, but we've seen it a million times walking past it. It gets old, and anyway, those guys are all dead. It's like being made to look at a bunch of dead people, so enough already. Blank walls, clean and simple, end of story.
Granger raked her fingers through her clammy hair, an irritable gesture.
So, Peter, let me remind you what a turkey is. It's a bird. It's got a kind of dangle of flesh hanging off its beak. Looks like a big trail of snot or, a condom. Its head is red, with little bumps on it, like lizard skin. And its head and neck are in an S shape, and they go like this. With her own head and neck, she acted out the ungainly motion of the bird. And then this scrawny, snake-like head and neck are attached to this oversized, fat, fluffy gray body. She looked Peter in the eyes. Ring any bells?
Yes, you've, brought it back to life for me.
Satisfied, she allowed herself to relax. That's it. That's what we've got to do. Keep the memories alive. She arranged her body more comfortably on the ground, stretching out as if sunbathing, using the tote bag as a pillow. A brilliant green insect settled on her shoulder and began to flex its hindquarters. She seemed unaware of it. Peter considered brushing it away, but let it be. A voice in his head said, "You are going to die here, in this wilderness. You will never see Beatrice again. This flat terrain, these sparse clumps of white flower, this alien sky, these insects waiting to lay eggs in your flesh, this woman at your side, they are the contents of your life in its final days and hours." The voice spoke clearly, without accent or gender. He'd heard it many times before, and always been certain it was not his own. As a child, he'd thought it was the voice of conscience. As a Christian, he trusted it was the voice of God. Whatever it was, it had always told him exactly what he needed to be told.
"What's your earliest memory?" Granger asked.
"I don't know," he said, after giving it thought. "My mum strapping me into a special plastic child seat at a Turkish restaurant, maybe. It's hard to know what's a real memory and what's something you construct afterward from old photos and family stories."
"Oh, don't be like that," she said, in the same tone she might have used if he declared that love was merely a meeting of sperm and ovum. "Tusker's big on that idea. No such thing as childhood memories, he says. We're just playing games with our neurons every day, tossing them around the hippocampus, constructing little fairy tales featuring characters named after people we used to live with. Your dad is just a flurry of molecular activity in your frontal lobe, he'll tell you, grinning that smug grin of his. Asshole." She held out her hand. Peter wasn't sure what she wanted him to do. Then he handed her the water bottle. She drank some. There wasn't much left. "My dad," she continued, "used to smell of gunpowder. We lived on a farm in Illinois. He was always shooting rabbits. They were just bugs to him. Big furry bugs. I'd ride around on my bicycle, and there'd be dead rabbits everywhere. Then later he'd sweep me up in his arms, and I'd smell the gunpowder on his shirt. A very, mixed emotion sort of memory," said Peter carefully. "It's a real memory. That's the important thing. The farm was real. The dead rabbits were real.
The smell on my father's shirt was gunpowder and not tobacco or paint or aftershave. I know. I was there.
She spoke defiantly, as if doubt had been cast on whether she was there, as if there was a conspiracy among the USIC personnel to reinvent her as a city kid from Los Angeles, the daughter of a Ukrainian dentist, a German Chinese. Two more insects had settled on her, one on her hair, the other on her bosom. She paid them no mind.
"What happened to your farm?"
asked Peter, for politeness's sake, when it became evident the conversation had stalled.
"Get the fuck out of my face!"
she exclaimed, clapping her hands to her eyes. He jerked back, preparing to apologize profusely for whatever he'd said to enrage her, but she wasn't addressing him. She wasn't even addressing the insects. With a cry of disgust, she cast a glittering shred first from one eye, then the other. Her contact lenses.
"The damn air," she said. "It was trying to get under my contacts, lifting them up at the edges. Creep me out."
She blinked. One discarded hydrogel petal was stuck to her shoe. The other lay on the soil.
"I shouldn't have done that. My eyesight is not good. You might end up leading me along."
"Where were we?" With effort, Peter retrieved the thread of the narrative.
"You were going to tell me what happened to the farm."
She rubbed her eyes, experimented with looking out of them.
"We went broke," she said. "The farm got sold and we moved to Decatur. We were in Bethany before. We weren't that far out, but we got ourselves a maisonette in the city, right near the Sangamon River. Well, not like walking distance or anything, but a short drive."
"Uh-huh," said Peter. He realized with a deep pang of melancholy that he was not in the least interested. So much for being a people person. If he survived, if he got back to civilization, his career as a minister was over. The minutiae of human beings' lives, the places they'd lived, the names of their relatives, the names of the rivers they'd lived near, the mundane complexities of the jobs they'd done and the domestic squabbles they'd endured, had ceased to have any meaning for him.
"Decatur is kind of a boring place now," reflected Granger. "But it's got some pretty amazing history. It used to be called the soybean capital of the world. You've heard of Abraham Lincoln?"
"Of course. Most famous of all American presidents." She exhaled gratefully, as if they had struck a blow against ignorance together. As if they were the only two educated people in a colony of Philistines. "Lincoln lived in Decatur way back in the 1700s or whenever. He was a lawyer then. He became president later. There's a statue of him with his bare foot on a stump. I sat on that stump when I was a little girl. I didn't think it was disrespectful or anything. I was just tired."
"Uh-huh," said Peter.
Insects were settling on him now, too. In a week or so, maybe in a few days, the two of them would be seedbeds. Maybe when the time came for them to breathe their last, they should be lying in each other's arms.
"I loved what you said at the funeral," she said.
"The funeral?"
"Severin's funeral. You made him so real, and I didn't even like him."
Peter struggled to recall what he'd said about Severin. Struggled to recall Severin at all.
"I had no idea you were impressed. It was beautiful."
She basked in the afterglow of his compassion for a few seconds. Then her brow wrinkled.
"Too beautiful for those dickwads, that's for sure. There was a meeting about it afterward, and everyone agreed you'd overstepped a line, and if there were any more deaths of USIC personnel in the future, it would be best to keep you out of it."
The insects were venturing back now. A lustrous jade one settled directly on her forehead. She was oblivious.
"I defended you," she said, staring up at the sky.
"Thank you." Resting on one elbow, he gazed at her. Her bosom rose and fell with her breath, just two lumps of fatty tissue on a ribcage, two milk bags designed to feed children she would never have. Yet to him, that bosom was intoxicatingly lovely, an aesthetic marvel, and the rhythmic swell of it made him desire her. Everything about her was miraculous. The downy hair behind her ear, the symmetry of her collarbones, her soft, flushed lips,
even the puckered scars on her arms. She wasn't his soulmate. He had no illusions about that. The intimacies he had once shared with B were impossible with her. She would quickly find him ridiculous, and he would find her too much trouble. In fact, like most men and women who had made love since the beginning of time, they had almost nothing in common, except that they were male and female, thrown together by circumstances, and, for the moment at least, alive. He lifted his hand, held it in space, prepared to settle his palm gently on her breast. "Tell me about your wife." Granger's eyes were closed now. She was tired, torpid in the heat, and a little drunk on the liquor of reminiscence. "She's turned against me," Peter said, withdrawing his hand. "We've grown apart." Although he intended merely to state facts, his words sounded peevish, craven, the cliched complaining of the typical adulterer. He could do better than this. "She's been having a horrific time back home. Everything is falling apart, all sorts of disasters, and she's lost her faith in God. Our cat Joshua got killed, tortured, and I think it pushed her over the edge. She's scared and lonely. I haven't been giving her the support she needs." Granger shifted the orientation of her body for comfort. One arm cradled her head, the other draped across her chest. She didn't open her eyes. "You're not telling me about B," she said. "You're telling me what's going on between you. Tell me about her, what she looks like, the color of her eyes, her childhood and stuff." He lay down next to her, rested his head on his arms. "Her name is Beatrice. She's a few years older than me, 36. She doesn't mind people knowing her age. She's the most unvain woman I've ever known. I don't mean in terms of appearance. She's beautiful and she dresses with style, but she doesn't care what other people think. She has pride in herself. Not a puffed-up pride, just self-esteem. That's so rare, incredibly rare. Most people are the walking wounded, you know. And B really ought to be, with the childhood she had. Her father was abusive, a total control freak. He burned everything she had several times, all her possessions. I mean everything, not just toys and books and special things, but everything. She remembers going to Tesco's, a supermarket in the industrial park that was open all night, with her mother. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. B was maybe 9 years old, and she was in her pajamas. She was barefoot, and her feet were blue, because it was January and snowing, and she'd had to walk from the car to the store. And her mother took her to the girls' wear section and bought her underpants, socks, t-shirts, shoes, trousers, the lot. That happened more than once. "Wow," said Granger, without any perceptible awe. Peter guessed she was comparing Bee's formative sufferings to her own and judging them to be no big deal. That's what people, unless they were shishchoda, tended to do. "What does she look like?" Granger said. "Describe her to me." "She has brown hair," said Peter. "Auburn." It was a struggle to conjure up a vision of B's hair as it really was. Maybe he was just recalling mentioning its color in other conversations. "She's tall, almost as tall as me. Brown eyes, slim." These details were generic, unevocative. They would fit a million women. But what was he to do? Describe the mole under her left nipple? The precise shape of her navel? "She's very fit. She's a nurse. We met at the hospital where she worked. I broke my ankles jumping off a ledge." "Ow. Were you trying to commit suicide?" "No, I was trying to escape from the police. I was a drug addict then. I did a lot of burglaries. That day, my luck ran out. Or I should say, I got lucky." Granger grunted agreement. "She lost her job over you? How did you know that?" He'd never shared this with her, he was pretty sure. "Just a guess. Nurse gets involved with patient, who's a drug addict, and a criminal. It doesn't look good. Did you ever go to jail?" "Not really. Detention in police cells, A fortnight once when I was awaiting trial and nobody would bail me out, that was about it. Only now did it strike him that he'd been shown extraordinary leniency.
Figures, said Granger in an odd philosophical tone.
What is it, Figure?
You're a lucky guy, Peter. One of life's charmed creatures. For some reason, this stung him. He wanted her to know he had suffered just as much as anyone.
I was homeless for a few years. I got beaten up.
He hoped he was speaking with quiet dignity rather than whining, but he suspected not.
All part of life's adventure, right? Said Granger.
There was no sarcasm in her voice, just a weary, tolerant sadness.
What do you mean?
She sighed.
Some people go through heavy stuff. They fight in wars. They're in jail. They start a business and it gets shut down by gangsters. They end up hustling their ass in a foreign country. It's one long list of setbacks and humiliations. But it doesn't touch them. Not really. They're having an adventure. It's like, what's next? And then there's other people who are just trying to live quietly. They stay out of trouble. They're maybe 10 years old or 14. And one Friday morning at 9:35, something happens to them. Something private. Something that breaks their heart. Forever.
He lay silent, absorbing what she'd said.
I felt that way, he said at last, when B told me it was over.
It began to rain again. Without shelter, they had no choice but to lie where they were and get soaked. Granger just closed her eyes. Peter watched her bra materializing again under her tunic, watched the contours of her breasts take shape. She hitched the sleeves off her arms, let the old injuries breathe. Each time he'd spent time with Granger, he'd wondered if a natural opportunity would arise to ask her about her self-harm. There would never be a better time than now. He tried to frame the question, but none of the obvious words, the whys and whens, would move from his brain to his tongue. He realized that he no longer wanted to know what caused those scars. Granger's pain was in the past, and there was no point revisiting it. Here, today, lying by his side, she was a woman with faint ridges on her arms. If he stroked her flesh gently, he would feel them. That was all. When the shower had moved on and the sun was warming them again, Granger said, Did you get married in a church or an office?
A church.
Was it a big, fancy wedding?
Not so much. No parents or family members on either side for various reasons. A few people from B's own church, which became my church in the end. In truth, he remembered nothing much about the event, but he remembered the light beaming through the windows, the way a grey November afternoon had been unexpectedly transformed by a sunburst. It was nice. I think everyone had a good time. And there was loads of alcohol, and I didn't drink. I wasn't even tempted, which was quite an achievement for me because, you know, I'm an alcoholic.
Me too, she said.
It never leaves you, he said.
She smiled.
Like God, huh?
More loyal than God.
They lay quietly for a while. Two small insects of the same species found each other on Granger's abdomen and started mating.
I bet Ella Reinman is a secret lush, she said.
Sorry?
A lush. American word for alcoholic. I thought you'd know that one.
Never too late for vocabulary building, he said.
She thinks she's so damn smart, bitched Granger. Thinks she can look right inside you and tell if you're ever going to drink again.
Well, she got it wrong with us, didn't she?
Peter was silent. Nothing would be gained by telling her that the booze she'd smelled on him when she dragged him out of Tartaglione's den was all spillage. Let her think they'd fallen off the wagon together. Let her think he'd broken his sacred promise. Let her think he'd lost his last shred of dignity. It was kinda that way.
I was a different person when I did that interview, she said. It was a million years ago. People change.
Yes, people change. The insects were finished and flew off.
Tell me about your wife's wedding dress, said Granger.
It was white, he replied. It was exactly what you imagine a wedding dress to be. Conventional,
nothing unusual about it, except that it was a huge symbolic statement, the whiteness of it. B had a terrible past, sexually. She was, let's just say she was used and abused, and she refused to be destroyed by it. Granger scratched at her arms. The repeated drenchings had activated an allergy in the scars. Not so much of the symbolism. Tell me more about the dress. He cast his mind back. He cast it across the galaxy, aiming for the bedroom of his home in England. It didn't have a huge flouncy train behind it, he said. It was a proper dress, a dress to move around in. It had puff shoulders, not balloony, just elegant, and then it was tight on the arms, with a brocade kind of texture, right down to the wrists. There was brocade on the abdomen as well, and on the collar, but the bosom was smooth and silky. The skirt was ankle length, it didn't touch the floor. Granger was nodding, humming. She was getting what she wanted. One of the amazing things about B, said Peter, is that she wore that dress many times afterward, at home, just for us. That's so romantic. There were tears in Granger's eyes. Peter felt suddenly disconsolate. The memory of B's bitter disappointment with him was more recent than these fond memories he was sharing with Granger. I suppose it's just a story I'm telling myself, like Tusker says, he said. An old story. Life has moved on. B is a different person. You know, not long ago, I wrote to her about the dress, about how much I loved her in it, and she said I was just being sentimental, focusing on a memory of who she used to be, not who she is now. Granger shook her head. That's bullshit, she said softly, tenderly even. Take it from me, Peter. Her heart swells up when you talk about that dress. She would be devastated if she thought you'd forgotten about that dress. Can't you see that? Everybody's sentimental. Everybody. There's only about 50 people in the whole damn world who aren't sentimental, and they're all working here. They both laughed. We should try once more to get back, said Peter. Okay, she said, and hauled herself to her feet. Her movements were stiffer than before. His too. They were carbon-based life forms, running low on fuel. An hour or so later, with the USIC base still eluding them, they found a structure of a different kind. It had shimmered in their sights for the longest time, and while heading for it, they discussed the possibility that it was a mirage. But it proved real enough. The skeletal remains of a large camping tent. The metal struts were intact, staking out the shape of a house, the kind of house a child would draw. The canvas hung in tatters. Inside the tent, nothing. No provisions, no bedding, no implements. A square of ground, a blank panel for the imagination to fill. Behind the tent, planted in the ground and only slightly tilted, a cross. A wooden one of very modest scale, about knee height. Where had the wood come from? Not from this world, that's for sure. It must have been transported, stashed in a ship along with the medicines and the engineering magazines and the raisins and the humans, billions of miles from its point of origin. Just two pine slats, never intended to be nailed together in this manner. Two sturdy slices of tree, varnished to resemble antique oak. Two nails were driven through the crux, one to join the two pieces of wood together, and another, crudely hammered and bent, to secure two small circlets of metal. Gold. Kurtzberg's wedding ring, and the wedding ring of the wife he'd lost in another galaxy long, long ago. On the horizontal slat of the cross, the minister had carved a message, then painstakingly blackened each letter with the flame of a cigarette lighter, or some similar tool. Peter expected a motto in Latin, or an allusion to faith or Christ or the afterlife. For all that I've had and seen, I am truly thankful, the inscription said. They stood and looked at that cross for several minutes, while the ragged remains of the tent flapped in the breeze. I'm going home, announced Granger, in a voice shaky with tears, to find my dad. Peter put his arm around her shoulders,
This was the moment when he was called upon to say the right thing. Nothing less than the right thing would do. As a man or as a minister of God, his challenge was the same: to reconcile them both to their fate. There would be no going home. There was no dad to be reunited with. They were lost, and soon they would be dead. Lightning had struck them, and they had failed to understand its message. "Granger," he began, his mind blank, trusting that inspiration would lend words to his tongue. But before he could continue, the dull thrum which they'd both imagined was the wind agitating the canvas shreds of the tent grew suddenly louder, and an olive-green military jeep drove past them, slowed to a stop, and reversed. A brown head with white eyes and white teeth poked out of the window.
"Are you guys finished here?" hollered BG, revving the engine. "'Cause some of us have work to do."
Chapter 26. He only knew that thanks were due. All the way back, Peter could hear, only hear, not see, the weeping and the labored breathing and the outbursts of anxiety and anger, sometimes incoherent, sometimes lucid. He was in the front passenger seat next to BG, almost shoulder to shoulder with the big man, although his own shoulder looked emaciated in comparison with BG's bulge of meat and muscle. Invisible in the space behind them, Alexandra Granger was going through hell. BG drove in silence. His normally benign face was a grim mask, frozen under the sheen of sweat, as he concentrated, or pretended to concentrate, on the road ahead. The road that was no road at all. Only his eyes betrayed any stress.
"They'd better not try to stop me," Granger was saying. "They can't keep me here. I don't care how much it costs. What are they going to do? Sue me? Kill me? I've got to go home. They can keep my salary. 4 years for free. That makes us even, right? They've got to let me go. My dad is still alive. I know he is. I feel it."
BG glanced up at the rearview mirror. Maybe from his angle he could see more than Peter. All Peter could see was a narrow rectangle of black upholstery which, through the distorted veil of the air currents trapped in the cabin, appeared to be pulsing and throbbing.
4 years as a pharmacist," Granger ranted on, "handing out drugs to those creepy little freaks. What's that worth, BG? Worth a ride on a ship?"
BG grimaced. Crises of confidence were not what he was accustomed to dealing with.
"Chill out, Granger, is my advice to you," he said pensively. "The cost ain't an issue. I've been back. Severin went back a couple times. A few other guys took a break too. Nobody slapped them with a bill. If you need to go, you need to go. No big deal."
"You really think so?"
Her voice was tremulous. The voice of a farm girl from Illinois who is deeply ashamed to waste millions of dollars of someone else's money to indulge her own pain.
"Money don't mean shit," said BG. "We play this little game. $10 for a bar of chocolate, $50 for a bottle of Pepsi, deducted from your salary, blah, blah, blah. It's just a Friday night card game, Granger. It's Monopoly, it's Go Fish, it's kids gambling for peanuts. The salary's a game too. Where are we going to spend this cash? We ain't going nowhere."
"But you did go home," said Granger. "Not that long ago. Why?"
BG's mouth set hard. He clearly didn't want to discuss it.
"Unfinished business."
"Family?"
BG shook his head.
"Call it loose ends. A guy in my line of work needs his mind clear. So I did some stuff and cleared it. Came back to the job a new man."
This silenced Granger for a few seconds. Then she was anxious again.
"But that's it. That's the whole point. You came back. You didn't quit. I've got to quit, you understand? I've got to leave and never come back. No way, never."
BG jutted out his chin.
"Never say never, Granger. Never say never. That's in the Bible somewhere. Ain't that right, Peter?"
"I'm not sure," Peter mumbled.
He knew perfectly well that the Bible said nothing of the sort.
It's gotta be right there in chapter 1, affirmed BG. God's advice to Moses and the whole crew. Seize the day. Get on top of it, people.
Peter watched BG's right hand rise up from the steering wheel and form a triumphal fist in the air. Long ago, in a previous life, BG had no doubt stood among other dark-skinned creatures in his Nation of Islam Brotherhood, all raising their fists likewise. Now, their slogans had mingled in BG's mind with 1,000 wind-blown leaves from the Quran, the Bible, assorted self-help books, magazines and TV programs, combining into a mulch from which his self-esteem grew healthy and strong. The Bible stored inside Peter was pure and unadulterated, not a word of it confused with anything else. And yet, for the first time, he was ashamed of it. The holy book he'd spent so much of his life preaching from had one cruel flaw. It was not very good at offering encouragement or hope to those who weren't religious. With God, nothing shall be impossible, proclaimed Luke. And that message, which Peter had always thought was the most joyously positive reassurance you could wish for, now turned itself over like a dying insect and became, without God, everything shall be impossible. What use was that to Granger? What use was that to B? The way things had turned out, they might need to manage without a savior. They might need to forage and scrabble for whatever future they could get on their own. And the thing about the Bible was, once you asked for a future without faith, the scriptures washed their hands of you. Vanity. All is vanity. What was it like, BG? Said Granger. Come on, tell me. What's happening back home?
This is my home now,
BG cautioned her, tapping his chest with his fingers. Maybe rather than referring to Oasis, the home he meant was his own body, wherever in space it might be located.
Okay, fine, fine, said Granger, barely controlling her annoyance. But tell me anyway, damn it. It's been so long since I left. There must have been big changes. Don't spare me, BG. Skip the pep talks. Give it to me straight. What's it like?
BG hesitated, weighing up the wisdom of responding.
Same as always, he said. That's not true, yelled Granger, instantly hysterical. Don't lie to me. Don't patronize me. I know everything's falling apart.
Why not ask me? Peter thought. She was treating him as if he didn't exist.
Everything's always been falling apart, BG stated calmly.
There was no defensiveness in his tone. The facts were too self-evident for dispute.
Planet Earth got fucked up a long time ago. Excuse my French.
That's not what I mean, whined Granger. I mean, what about your old neighborhood? Where you grew up? Your relatives? Your house?
BG squinted through the windscreen at the expanses of nothingness, then glanced down at the navigation gadget on his dashboard.
Granger, I got another wise old saying for you. Listen up. You can't go home again.
Thomas Wolfe, circa 1940, thought Peter helplessly.
Yeah, well, just watch me, said Granger, belligerent in her fear. Just fucking watch me.
BG was silent, obviously judging that Granger was on too delicate a hair trigger for more discussion. But the silence provoked her just as much.
You know what you are,
she wheezed, her voice ugly as if soaked in alcohol.
You're just a little boy, running away from home. Big tough guy, but you can't face reality. All you can do is pretend it's not happening.
BG blinked slowly. He did not lose his temper. He had no temper left to lose. That was his tragedy, and his mark of dignity, too.
I faced all the reality I gotta face, Granger, he said, without raising his voice. You don't know what I've done, and what I have not done. You don't know where I came from, and why I left. You don't know who I've hurt, and who's hurt me. You ain't seen my scorecard, and I ain't gonna show it to you. You want a juicy fact about my daddy? He'd die when he was the exact age I am now. A blood vessel in his heart got blocked up. Bye-bye, Billy Graham Sr. And all you need to know about me is, if I inherited that same blood vessel and I die next week,
Well, I'm okay with it.
BG changed gear, slowed the vehicle down. They were approaching the base.
In the meantime, Granger, whenever you need a ride out of the desert, I'm your man.
She was quiet after that. The vehicle's wheels made the transition from Earth to tarmac, giving the illusion of airborne cruising. BG parked in the shadow of the compound, right in front of the entrance nearest Granger's quarters, then scooted round and opened the car door for her. A perfect gentleman.
Thank you, she said.
She had not acknowledged Peter's presence for the duration of the drive. Peter twisted round in his seat to catch a glimpse of her as she was maneuvering her stiff, weary body out of the car. BG's arm was offered like a metal rung. She took hold of it and pulled herself up. The door slammed shut, and Peter continued to watch through the fogged window. Two white-clad USIC personnel shimmering in and out of recognizability, like degraded video images. He wondered if they would walk into the building side by side, arm in arm. But as soon as Granger was on her feet, she broke free and was gone.
I figure it's the lightning, said BG when he returned to the car. Can't be good for a person being whammoed like that. Give her time. She'll get over it.
Peter nodded. He was unsure if he would get over it himself.